Grazie America. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grazie miteinander and welcome to a new episode of Views from the Sister Republic. As Ohio goes, so goes the nation. That's an old saying in American politics. Ohio is reputed to be a microcosm of the United States. Since 1896, the majority of its electors voted for the presidential winner on all but three occasions. The last time the nation decided differently than Ohio was in 2020, when Trump won Ohio by 8 points, but, as we all know, lost overall. Political observers were quick to declare that Ohio was no longer a representative state, was no longer the bellwether state. But Ohio came back in 2024, as it also backed Donald Trump with 55.2% of the votes cast on his behalf, and Kamala Harris trailing behind with 43.9%. So is Ohio still the representative state? And in what ways is Ohio really representative of the US and its problems at large? It's definitely worth getting to know Ohio a bit more, since it is America's seventh largest economy, comparable in fact to this very country, Switzerland, and it might hold many clues to understand the United States better. And I have the ideal guest to learn more about Ohio and its significance, Chris Redfern. Welcome to Grazie America.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to say hello for the next how many minutes or an hour, and introduce you and reintroduce you and perhaps your listeners to Ohio, Ohio politics, its impact in the United States and perhaps globally as well. As you mentioned, Ohio was a bellwether state for more than a century, but it seems it may be slipping away from that title. I'm grateful to be invited to say hello.
And I'm so grateful to have you on because you have been observing and living Ohio politics for quite a long time. You were the chair of the Ohio Democratic Party from 2005 to 2014, and you were a member of the Ohio House of Representatives for 12 years. Nowadays, you run an inn and a winery, Rocky Point Winery on Lake Erie. And you dive into both national and state politics on your own podcast, Pinot and Politics. We only have water now because it's a bit too early in the day to have a glass of wine, at least in my kind of lifestyle. But we still want to have that same depth to the discussion as you usually have on Pinot and Politics. So yeah, now you've already said Ohio has been slipping from its role as the bellwether state. So you think the times when Ohio could be called a representative state are definitely over?
Well, it depends on a few things. First, having traveled to Switzerland and to Europe, to Germany, to Italy, let's talk about wine first.
Okay.
Even though it doesn't matter if it's early in the morning or later in the evening, it just simply doesn't matter. It's always a great time to have a beautiful glass of, say, German Riesling, which is beautiful, by the way. It's the acidic balance is beautiful for all German Rieslings in this case. Italian super reds, Tuscan reds, love them all. Now, we produce seven of our own wines here in Ohio. Ohio's, as you mentioned, the seventh largest state in the union, seventh largest economy, and the seventh largest producer of grapes. So winemaking is very important, far more important than politics, of which, as you mentioned, I've been involved with more than 30 years. And Ohio, as you noted, picked the winner more times than not. And when I was chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, I was member of the National Democratic Committee. I ran the campaign for President Obama twice in 2008 and 2012. Now we go ahead a decade and a couple of years, and it seems we have lost our way in Ohio, speaking from my own personal political beliefs. and we've slipped far more to the right. But I think that has to do not just with the ideological movement of the voter, but also something called gerrymandering here in the United States. In states, as you know, like Ohio, congressional lines and legislative lines are drawn, not arbitrarily, they're drawn to suit whoever is in power, the Republicans in this case in power. And so when you draw lines that help Republicans will get elected, and it suppresses the vote for Democrats. And while I think Donald Trump and his abilities to speak directly to American voters cannot be, you know, understated, he's very talented as a communicator, much to my chagrin. But it's also how the lines are drawn. And that's why Ohio has lost its way politically, and why people like me and others are speaking out, whether it's modestly through a podcast or traveling across the state talking about the issues that matter. And you and I are witnessing that right now globally, and the impact of a Donald Trump presidency as we enter, as we soon will enter the second year of his four-year term.
But I mean, in the case of presidential elections, as well as the elections for your senators, gerrymandering doesn't really play a role. So what have these Republican voices, I mean, you have now with Bernard Morino and John Ellenhusted, two Republicans in the Senate. Before that, you had now Vice President J.D. Vance representing Ohio in the Senate.
Sure.
What has made Ohio more receptive to the messages of Trumpist Republicanism?
Well, two things. First, even those Senate seats, as we all know, there are two United States senators for every state, and they're not chosen through lines. When a congressional line, however, is drawn, oftentimes those lines include parts of urban communities where television and radio stations are located. And that megaphone for the Republicans has allowed John Husted and Bernie Moreno to break through, whereas 25 years ago, when Democrats controlled the urban centers and gerrymandering had not carved up those cities, the only voices that were being heard were Democratic voices. And while the United States Senate is different, of course, than the Congress, the impact of messaging is really, really important. Ohio has 17 different media markets. If you control the media markets, you often control what's being heard back at home. And that's why, you know, building upon that, right now in the United States, television stations are privately owned. And when they're privately owned by huge corporations that benefit from a Trump presidency, the voice of opposition, the voice of reason, the voice of a progressive left is left out of those discussions.
Can you briefly explain to our listeners what it means when you say that Ohio has seven different media markets? Because we are a 9 million inhabitants nation, and imagining what it means to be an 11 million inhabitant state with regards to media markets is a bit hard.
Sure, and I'll use language, because if, as you know, if you are in parts of Switzerland, you may be speaking French, or you may be speaking German, or in the southern, very southern part of Switzerland, maybe some Italian. Maybe it's an Austrian dialect of German. Whatever the case is, in Ohio, there are 17 media markets. So you have a town like Cleveland that has a 500,000 inhabitants, but a media market of 2 million people. In southern Ohio, in Cincinnati, the same thing. What happens in Cincinnati is as different as what happens in parts of Switzerland, east versus west, and how one communicates out to the listeners is really important. There's not seven media markets, there's 17.
Oh, wow.
Because the media market in Toledo also includes Detroit, Michigan. The media market in Southeast Ohio, which is parts of Ironton, also covers Huntington, West Virginia. So culturally, it's very different. What is important in Toledo is not important in Cincinnati. But if the company controls the media market, then they control the voices that are being heard. And it's really important for all of us in Ohio politics, in American politics, to use not just traditional, conventional media like television, like radio, but also podcasts, online, communicating via Facebook messaging, Substacks, Reddit, however you can communicate regionally, statewide, regionally, nationally, globally. We have to take advantage of that. And Democrats have not done a very good job at that. If you look at what's called, we call the blogosphere, what you and I are doing on a video blog, essentially a podcast, Democrats didn't have a voice for a decade. And they had a lot to do with how we held on, clung to the past, and how we communicated to the people. If you're under 30, you're not sitting up in America. You watch the nightly news at 6 p.m. or 6:30 p.m. If you're under 30, you haven't watched the nightly news on your local affiliate probably ever. You grab it on YouTube. Jimmy Kimmel, who hosts a late night television show here in Ohio, in America, he's a comedian. He gets 10 times the number of views on YouTube than he ever will by appearing on ABC. We have not done a good enough job pushing back on Donald Trump's bigotry, his prejudice, his volatile nationalism, as well as we should have, not just in the last year, but dating back to when he was first elected over Hillary Clinton all those years ago. We've just not done and we in America are less alarmed by the rise of nationalism and bigotry and the mainstream prejudice that's occurring because we're an island nation. Now, the EU and what has occurred over the course of the last 30 years with a more borderless Europe, just currency is a good example. Using the euro in three different countries. In America, that would never happen in our minds. In using that as an example, these walls that we have around us, the oceans, we're not confronted with the same kind of rise of nationalism that has occurred in Hungary. And what does that mean in Romania? What does that mean in Bulgaria? What does that mean as you spread from Eastern Europe across to Western Europe? The rise of nationalism in France, the impact of the immigration has had just until Donald Trump was elected in 2016. And we never pushed back on some of his language until now. It's very, very difficult.
But to what extent do you see the economic conditions in Ohio having contributed to the rise of the Republican Party?
Because the number one industry in Ohio is agriculture. Although we're home to big cities, there's 11.5 million people live in our state. You know, and as I mentioned, million in Greater Cleveland, million in Greater Cincinnati, more than 2 million in Greater Columbus. Well, that's only 4 million people. There are 88 what we call counties, which are subdivisions of the state, and 70 of those counties would be considered rural. And in rural communities, agriculture is the number one industry. And in Ohio, like the Midwest, in rural communities, there's more of a conservative political ideology. And when I say conservative, not focused on immigration, not focused on the Donald Trump brand of conservatism, more conservative about religion, social values, our approach to taxation. Folks are a little more conservative, but conservative and more in a 1970s, 1980s way, not conservative in a Donald Trump way. And so because of that, it was viewed as a conservative state, conservative-minded state. In the urban region, of course, it was more liberal, more progressive. And therein lied how we turned out the vote, focusing on urban districts through media, through traditional mechanisms, turn out our vote, and we would win. Well, that's all changed because Donald Trump's language in rural Ohio has resonated in urban Ohio as well, especially about within white, middle-aged, think 40 to 60 age male voters without a college education. And guess what? In Ohio, there's a hell of a lot of those people. And Donald Trump's language, America first, who could be against that if you're a good American? Red-blooded Americans should say, America first without understanding the implications, the implicit suggestions that Donald Trump has now made explicit, especially in his second term.
But do you see other causes rather than, I mean, what you've described is essentially a cultural phenomenon that in rural areas, you do have conservatism that dates back for generations. That is also a different brand of conservatism than what we see dominating. But the fact that Trumpist conservatism or whatever we want to call it has been able to spread to urban areas. Aside from the fact that we are dealing with a very charismatic presidential persona here, that we are seeing someone who's very media savvy, who reaches particularly young male voters through the channels that they are consuming, and Democrats have probably been late to catch up to that. Do you also see more substantive reasons why you've seen these developments? Because Paul Krugman, for instance, in the New York Times a year ago wrote, "What's the matter with Ohio?" And he essentially said, well, they have been losing out economically, educationally. So is that the clue to this puzzle?
Who do we blame? Who do we blame? It's the age-old crisis. Who do we blame? Well, we know who we blamed in the late 1800s across Eastern Europe. We blamed those people. And the perception was those people controlled money. And if you control money, you control land. If you control land, you control commodities. If you control commodities, you control the peasant farmer. And the peasant farmer rose up. And who led them? You know, authoritarians, people who use language. We would not think in America that we would turn off the internet like they've turned off the internet in parts of Russia in the buildup to the Ukrainian war. Commonplace in Afghanistan, you turn off the internet. In America, you don't turn off the internet. You make sure that whoever owns parts of the internet worships at the altar of Donald Trump. Thus, you control language. You control opposition. In the late 1920s into 1930s, if you look at the collapse of the Weimar Republic and what came next, we all know what came next, but there were steps. There was an election. There was then obedience. There was then a turning over of power. We are seeing that not to the level of 1932-33 in Germany, but we're seeing a lot of the same kind of approaches, isolating those people we can blame for our problems. And as Paul Krugman points out, in Ohio, the economic policies of the country in the last 30 years have hurt Ohioans, steelworkers, farmers, iron workers, people who build cars. Well, who do we blame for that? Well, we blame the people where the finger is pointed towards. And Donald Trump has allowed us to blame the very people who have nothing to do with the collapse of industrialized economy in Ohio. We now get to blame undocumented immigrants. We get to blame liberals. We get to blame this cloudy, murky, maybe group called Antifa. And it makes us feel better because we can now place our blame on someone or something and say, it wasn't our fault. It wasn't because we elected Republicans in the 1990s who cut public education and trades programs so we didn't have a viable workforce confronted with this changing global economy. We get to blame that black kid or that Mexican kid or that Guatemalan kid or that Syrian kid or whatever, because it makes us feel better. Krugman points out and has always pointed out that as you carve up the middle class, there's nothing left. There's nothing left with the exception of discontent, a lack of a future, no middle class to think of, pain and suffering. Well, there's a lot of pain and suffering in a lot of countries over the course of the last 2,000 years. And we are going through this right now in the United States.
But so you would say that the Republicans have been able to identify the discontent and give people an opening as to who they are pointing the finger towards. And what then was the mistake of the Democrats, not having a proper plan, not using the proper channels?
I hate to be so direct and coarse, because we didn't think we were 1932 Germany. This can't happen. This is not Hungary. This is not Turkey. This is not areas in countries in the last 10 years. Look at Hungary. This is the United States. That can't happen here. There can't be masked police forces rounding people up and putting them into camps in the United States. It doesn't happen here. We'll have a debate on the Senate floor. We'll have a chance to filibuster. We'll have a chance to debate in the public arena. Meanwhile, the Republicans are placing people in control of government that dictate what you can and can't post on Facebook. Yesterday, Facebook took down a public community group in Chicago that was tracking ICE and customs agents across Chicago in Cook County where they were. So in real time, you would know where they were. Police cars, you know when a police car is in your neighborhood, you can see them. You can post that online, but you can't do that now on Facebook. And what do Democrats do now about that? What do we do? Well, for the last decade, we've sat on our hands, fighting amongst ourselves in these performative debates on who's the better progressive. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and his powerful allies have taken control of the very levers of government in the United States. It's a very scary time in the United States. And I'm not practicing hyperbole. This has happened in the past in other areas of the world. It's happening now in the United States.
Well, you're focusing very much on what is happening now nationally, but my question was more towards what have the failures been of the Democratic Party that actually allowed Donald Trump to be elected? Or do you not see any failures on the side of the Democratic Party?
Plenty of failures. We have not communicated with white working Democrats in 35 years. We did not accept the obligation and the responsibility and the pain of the passage of the free trade laws that were passed between Mexico, Canada, and the United States under a Democratic administration, Bill Clinton, with Republicans in the Congress and Democrats in the Congress passing the free trade bills of the 1990s. We did not take responsibility. We had and have a party that is largely funded by West Coast elites, people with extraordinary amounts of money who may disagree with Donald Trump and may be liberal, but we have ignored the 40 states in the middle. When you accept money from a certain population and ignore another, there is a certain amount of animus that's going to be created amongst the two. And we will ignore then the concerns, in this case, white working class voters in places like Ohio. Ohio is neighbored by Indiana and Illinois and Michigan. And while Michigan and Illinois have Democratic governors, they still have populations similar to Ohio that have concerns, anxiety about trade policies of 30 years ago and how they've hurt us. Remember, Donald Trump said, I'm going to stand up for working class people. I am going to rebuild the manufacturing base in this country. I am going to impose tariffs on countries that abuse us.
We have noticed that, yeah.
Yes. And it's counterintuitive, of course, if you understand the global commodities market. But if you don't, and you live in a small town in Ohio, and you are just struggling with rent, that convenient blame game that the Chinese or the Canadians or some country is sending too much aluminum to the United States at deflated prices, that sounds good. I can tell you, I own a winery. My cost of glass bottles has increased 25%. 25%.
Yeah.
I'm a small business person. That's a lot of money. It's a lot that just goes out. But if you're saying, I'm going to defend the people who make glass in Toledo, Ohio, this sounds good. I'm going to put a tariff on Mexican glass. Wow, good. But it doesn't work out overnight. It doesn't change. You don't build a glass-making a company for wine bottles in Toledo overnight or expand your production lines. It just doesn't work like that. So tariffs, while sounding good to folks who've been ignored by Democrats, it hurts the very people that are now supporting them. But you're seeing in Ohio, when Democrats have ignored that messaging and ignored how to respond, ignored white working class, we've also ignored farmers. But now you're seeing a different. There's been a collapse of the soybean market in the United States. There's similarly the dismantling of the corn and other grain markets in the United States from a commodity standpoint. We're not exporting to the levels that we once did. And these grain prices have hurt farmers. And farmers are now looking for an alternative voice, thankfully. Can Democrats respond with that alternative voice? Well, to respond, you have to understand how to talk to farmers. Farmers don't want to just talk about whether or not trans kids should have bathrooms that are accessible. They don't want to talk about marriage equality. They want to talk about how they can make payments on their combine because of collapse in the soybean market. They don't want to have cultural wars right now. They've got a payment they got to make in November on their combine. How do they make that payment? That's right now.
I mean, you know every county of your state. You've traveled it up and down during your years as chair of the Democratic Party. You've mentioned that one group of the constituents in Ohio is already dissatisfied with the direction the economy is going, the agricultural sector. What about other sectors? How satisfied how disillusioned are Ohioans with the choice they made last November?
Well, if you're a union member who builds roads and bridges, you're somewhat pleased because there's a lot being invested in public infrastructure right now. And so you're working. And you're a skilled, so-called skilled tradesperson. So you're an iron worker or a steel worker, a laborer. You're working. But oddly enough, you're building bridges that were funded by Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. It goes back to why didn't Democrats explain that it was the very policies of Joe Biden that are put people to work today? What's standing between us and a recession in Ohio is the very money that was invested by Joe Biden and Democrats in the Congress to literally build things. Okay. Donald Trump, as you see, he's putting his face on a gold coin. He's putting his name on buildings. He's building a ballroom and he's standing next to it saying, I'm going to build a ballroom at the White House. And Democrats roll their eyes and say, this guy is so full of shit. But guess what? If you brand it, people will be proud of it. And they will like that the bridge you're building in Cincinnati, Ohio, funded by Democrats, is being built by Democrats. Now, Donald Trump may be president now, but the money was appropriated then. We haven't talked about that in Ohio, across the country. We don't talk about, as Democrats, all the good that we do. You know this healthcare crisis? It was a Democrat who created the reduction, the tax credits that create a healthcare program that's a little more affordable, not totally affordable, but a little more affordable. But we talk about a healthcare crisis. What we should be talking about are 11-year-olds who get their tonsils out, could bankrupt a family living in Lima, Ohio, because they don't have the $2,000 for the copay. We talk in dramatically verbose, high-minded ways. Donald Trump doesn't do it. He cuts right to it. He did it in Gaza. He did it with Israel. He does it with Russia now. Oddly enough, he says to Putin, if you don't stop, you'll regret it. you'll regret it. He says to Gaza, in the war, the unnecessary war and reaction, the overreaction from Israel into Gaza, Donald Trump said, I will blow you to I will let him blow you to smithereens. He will destroy all of you. He will turn it to dust. He uses language that is coarse and direct, and it works.
But how can Democrats make their message stick? Or how can they find a message that sticks? Because you sound very direct. You sound like the problems are identifiable, but we need now the heads to actually address them in a proper way. And you said earlier that, well, you need someone who is able to talk to farmers when you want to bring these problems also to national attention. So where are the Democrats that can do this, particularly looking ahead to the midterms and then 2 years ahead, further ahead as well?
You need first and foremost courage. You have to have the courage to say out loud the things that need to be said. Two, you need a little bit of money to help spread the word beyond just standing by your front door and yelling out the door. You need the resources to get the word out. You need to organize in communities that have been ignored by Democrats for 30 or 40 years. Because you may have the right message, you may have a little bit of money, but if you're just talking in your front yard, you've got to go to the communities that have been impacted. And fourth, you have to find people who can speak in those communities that know of those communities. The governor of Michigan comes from a district. She was a state legislator, like I was. So if you have a complaint for a state legislator, you're going to see them at a local restaurant, and you're going to come up and talk to them about it, and the legislator has to communicate back. It's very, very good training. So she can go in rural Michigan, and she can go in urban Michigan and feel quite comfortable in her response. Democrats in Ohio have to create that kind of approach with what I would call a rapid response team made up of folks who come from rural Ohio speaking to rural voters. And there are those of us. I'd ask your listeners to Google Chris Gibbs from Ohio. He is a farmer, used to be a Republican. He's from a county, Shelby County in southern Ohio. He's a grain farmer, and he posts online almost every day, the impact of Donald Trump's policies on farmers in Ohio and across the Midwest. Farmers aren't stupid. They know that the trade policies that have closed down exports into places like China, Brazil, Argentina, other places where you sell commodities, when you shut those down because of trade wars, farmers get hurt. But if I were to say it, I'm just a winery owner in northern Ohio. It doesn't translate, but Chris Gibbs can. And there are other gifted communicators who can get the word out. But this is a slow process that we have to be committed to. It won't change. 30 years of neglect and wither cannot be changed overnight. And that's why myself and a whole bunch of other well-meaning folks are speaking up, having the courage to say, Donald Trump and his policies are wrong, and why they're wrong. And then here's the alternative. It's a lot of work, but it needs to be done.
And who's the Chris Gibbs for national politics?
Well, we've got a lot of folks who are very good. We have a generation problem in Ohio and in the country as well. We got a lot of old white guys who used to run the Democratic Party. Now, I like old white guys being one, but maybe we got to look for a new generation of leadership in the United States Congress. And regionally as well as governor candidates to take this message forth. You got to feel comfortable. There's a reason why we wear blue jeans. They're comfortable. You got to have people who are comfortable to listen to as well. And sometimes Chuck Schumer is not comfortable. He's just not comfortable. He's the minority leader in the United States Senate. He's the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. The guy's got to be 78 years old. Yeah, I don't know.
He's even older.
God bless America. You mentioned that you've had you had a topic of Taylor Swift. You got to know what the hell the Eras Tour was all about. And oh, by the way, you got to know that she's a $1 billion industry in and of herself, right?
Well, I'm pretty sure Gavin Newsom knows these things, but I'm not sure whether he can talk to farmers the way that you outlined should be necessary.
It's the number two economy in California is agriculture. So if you spent time in the Central Coast region, if you spent time as I have in Northern California among the ranchers and the grape growers and dairy farmers across the state, you get a better understanding. Gavin Newsom's done a great job because he's using different avenues to get his voice out. He does a lot of podcasts. He speaks direct to camera on YouTube posts that he controls. He does a lot of social media. He also uses parody. He makes fun of Donald Trump, which is great. Now, you could make fun of George Bush. You could make fun of Bill Clinton, and you wouldn't get thrown in prison. You make fun of Donald Trump, he's gonna come after you. But Gavin Newsom has the political abilities to understand that and to navigate the response. And he's been very, very effective, as has J.B. Pritzker, who's got a couple of $1 billion in his wallet and is a stronger voice for working folks and gets the issues. He's the governor of Chicago, of Illinois, and lives in Chicago. So you've got voices out there generationally that are younger, but we need more. We need more AOCs, who, as you know, is the congresswoman from New York. Terrific voice.
But isn't the brand of progressivism that AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, represents part of the problem of the Democratic Party?
No, it's not part of it. We've got to embrace the fact that we're a quilt. And you have to also say, look, I'm pro-choice, by the way. One of my best political friends is a guy named Jim Obergefell, who is the name litigant on Obergefell v. Hodges that created marriage equality in the United States before the Supreme Court. He is somebody who is a friend of mine. I will never retreat from core progressive values, but my job is not to get into political heaven and meet little baby Jesus in political heaven. My job is to win a majority in the Congress so that we can change the policies of Donald Trump. If you're right on the issues and you're just out on the street screaming, you're just getting a bad voice. But if you can translate that energy like AOC has and be a voice in the United States Congress and a vote, then you'll win. That's our job. We don't say you're too liberal or you're too conservative to be a Democratic. We don't say you're too liberal and what you're saying about immigration will hurt us as Democrats. What we're saying is a little bit of you are right, a little bit of you are right, but who's going to stand up for working people and throw Donald Trump to the curb? We can do this together, bring people together. The leader of Canada did this in the Liberal Party, Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada. He has been able to do that, to bring disparate parts of the Canadian political environment together to ensure that a conservative's not elected. Look at France. It's the same thing. God help us if Le Pen takes over all of French politics. God help us. It's Hungary to your west. It's not good. Look at Germany. The impact of immigration on Germany presented so many challenges for so-called progressive politicians, especially in urban areas of Germany. And the pressure that immigration has brought, political pressure, how do you respond? You got to speak about all of the issues that are confronting EU countries and ask, do you want to be Hungary or do you want to be Germany?
Next year, Ohio is going to vote for a new governor. And you have, of course, as is always the case with midterm elections, that you have 15 seats in the House of Representatives up for grabs. Currently, of these 15 seats, 10 belong to the Republican Party. What is your prediction? Will the Ohio Democratic Party be able to turn that tide?
Donald Trump told states like Texas, Ohio, Kansas, Missouri, Florida, that they should redistrict to not make it 10-5 in Ohio, but make it 12-3. So I think we'll lose two seats in the Congress in Ohio. It doesn't matter what we do because of the impact of gerrymandering. What we have to do is focus our resources on electing a governor in the state who can take forward new policies to convince folks who have left us in the last 30 years to join us yet again. Right now, there's a person running for governor for the Democrats in Ohio named Amy Acton. She was a physician who led the response during COVID for Ohio. She worked for the Republican governor at the time. And there is another potential candidate, Tim Ryan, who's a former United States congressman. Those will be the two candidates running for governor if Tim runs. Those two folks will offer an alternative to Vivek Ramaswamy. You remember that name?
Oh, yeah.
He helped Elon Musk run the Doge project for Donald Trump for the first month or so of the Trump second administration. Vivek Ramaswamy is running for governor in Ohio. Now, Vivek Ramaswamy is an ideologue. He's a Trump acolyte. If Donald Trump says jump, Vivek Ramaswamy will say how tall, how high. But what people need to know about Vivek Ramaswamy is he said that eating meat is a moral question. And if you eat chickens, cows, and pigs, you are making an immoral decision because those are sentient animals and they should be treated and accorded with the same rights as dogs and cats. Now,
doesn't sound like a winning message for rural America.
We can have a debate about whether or not he's right. And maybe his religious foundation guides him in that decision. That's great. That's a philosophy class that's probably taught in your university. But in a state like Ohio that is meat forward, that is a recipe for political disaster. So we as Democrats have to talk about that. There's a lot of farmers in this state that raise cows and chickens and pigs that are used in agriculture and in the industry of food production. It employs thousands and thousands of people. We have to talk about that. And oh, by the way, Vivek Ramaswamy ran the program that dismantled the VA and then cut Medicaid benefits for working Ohioans. More than a million Ohioans received Medicaid, and he cut it. And why? Why? Because Donald Trump told him to. So now we have to talk about that, and we will. We will.
But you first need to rally behind one candidate. So
we do.
How destructive is it really for the upcoming election that you have this, from European perspectives, rather strange system that the party doesn't decide on its own, but first has a public bloodbath?
It's so interesting that it's so true because there's no party convention that gets to pick the prime minister. There's no coalition government where a couple of folks get together and say, I got 12 votes, you got 15. Let's pick so-and-so to be the prime minister candidate so that we can run against Orban or somebody, Le Pen or somebody like that. There's none of that. So we have our primary. We have to say these words. I may disagree with my Democratic primary opponent, but if he or she won, she would be so much better than Vivek Ramaswamy. And here's why. And tell people what we agree on before we tell what we disagree on amongst ourselves. I think the person who works the hardest in this case with that message will win the primary. And then they can focus 6 months later on defeating Vivek Ramaswamy and Donald Trump in the November election. This will be a national election, even though it's a gubernatorial election. The Senate race is a good example of that. These are national elections where hundreds of millions of dollars will be raised to defeat the Donald Trump agenda. And that agenda is seen at the gubernatorial level and at the Senate level the same. This is us versus them.
And I think the entire world will be watching.
Yeah, I sure
now,
hope.
You have been officially for a decade out of state politics, but you sound as if you haven't retired at all. What will be your role next year?
Well, you have an obligation. You know, we, those of us in this business, we carry a responsibility. I was an elected official for a long, long time. I represented people, and I still see my neighbors who were the people that elected me. So I can't retreat from the obligation of speaking truth to power. And quite frankly, I don't give a shit about what Donald Trump says or thinks about me. So I'm an American with an American passport, and if ICE wants to come in front of my yard and give me a hard time, let them come. There are those of us who have a voice. We have to use that voice, because it's as St. Paul told us in his letter to the Romans in the New Testament of the Bible, it's the obligation of the strong to accept the infirmities of the weak, to stand up for the little guy, to push back, to do what is right. And I'm guided by that in public life. And so while I may not be an elected official anymore, I have a laptop and an iPhone and a voice, and I'll keep using it. I drive all across the state talking about these issues, and I'll continue to do that, because when you're right, in my belief, we are correct in our beliefs, you have that obligation to get the voice out. And so there are many of us in Ohio and across the Midwest doing this. And because of that work, I find that we may be successful in stopping the Trump agenda, whether it's with a Democratic-controlled Congress, Democratic-controlled Senate, or more governors, including Ohio, across the Midwest and beyond. And then what happens the day after the midterm elections? We start talking about the presidential election 2 years later. Americans love to talk about politics. They love it.
Even though sometimes I think many of them get very tired of it as well.
Well, they do, but they still talk about it, don't they? I mean, they say, well, I hate negative campaigning. And then they all throw rotten tomatoes at each other, you know?
And we watch sometimes in disgust or in wonder or sometimes with amusement, but we do keep watching.
I knew that because when my first time I went to Geneva was the first time I saw graffiti in Geneva. It said "fuck Bush," and that was after the attack, the invasion of Iraq. So it was coarse, of course. It was direct. It was brazen. But it was correct. And while Europeans watch Americans, a lot of them agree that it's time we push back on the policies of the far right.
Well, we'll be interested to see what you will contribute to that. We can listen to that, actually, continuously with your podcasts, Pinot and Politics, or Politics and Pinot. Now I'm quite confused.
Pinot and Politics.
Pinot, the wine is always first, right?
You always have to drink first. It makes everything better.
Oh, that's a good motto.
Yes,
now, For our listeners, what does someone who is truly a political animal listen or read to yourself to be always up to date on what is going on? What would you say do listeners need to discover for themselves?
Well, you know, I'm not one to say you should turn the channel away from Fox News or from some of those kinds of networks that just carry a Republican voice. I think you have to understand what the other side is saying. So my advice to Europeans as they look at this unfolding in the United States, first, we're all cousins. So we know what has happened and what will happen in the United States has happened elsewhere. We also know that there's always a response. There's always a Labor Party. There's always a Progressive Party. There's always a Green Party. There's always a Liberal Party that's going to work hard to put a coalition together to push back against failed policies. That's happening in the United States. This is not just Donald Trump and all hell has broken out. There is a loyal opposition that's doing the work. And you can find out more by just looking at the comment section of the New York Times, just going to the Los Angeles Times, just going to the ToledoBlade.com and looking at the comments. There is an underlying of work being done to push back on the forces of Donald Trump. Now, what you can also do for Americans living abroad, expats living abroad, they can get involved in Democrats Abroad. It's called Democrats Abroad. It's an actual organization within the DNC. And in every major European capital, there is a chapter of Democrats Abroad where folks are meeting and talking about how they can how they can help people get elected back home. You can support folks financially if you're an American living abroad. You can write a check. You can send back words of advice to candidates in your hometown back in the States. Do those kinds of things. And if you're a Swiss national or a German national or Italian, you can use your voice too. You can use your voice in support of policies in your local canton, your local community, your local town, your state, your country, wherever you live, to lift your voice up, because we are in this global fight against authoritarianism. And it may look like just talking about Ohio. This is global. What we do in Ohio will matter in 2026. And I hope, because it will matter in 2026, we'll be a bellwether again in 2028.
A bellwether again. That's a great closing phrase. Thank you so much, Chris, for taking us to Ohio, albeit only in stories and in your analysis. Thank you so much for your time and your passion. And thank you, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Grüezi Amerika. And with that, auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you.
Grüezi Amerika. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.